What I thought I would start with, actually, is a little bit of an ambitious effort, and that is just because it's been, how many months now?
Many.
A long time.
June. 4 months.
June.
Too long.
June. Too long. June. Too long. It's hard. Summers are very hard, and Elul is virtually impossible for me, and then you have all the Chagim, which were knocked out a month. And so by the time you're done, it's really hard to you're in Cheshvan, exactly. Be that as it may, I thought it would be an important moment in a kind of transition between a break that we had and where we were up to look at a bird's eye view review of Sefer Shmuel up to this point. So what I wanted to do with you literally is to walk us through a review of the first 11 chapters of the Sefer. That's our goal for today, and then to pick up a couple of loose ends at the end of Perek Yud Aleph, and to be ready for Perek Yud Bet, hopefully next week. So this is this page that I just gave you.
Yep.
You have to put the extras on the table over there. Sikum Prakim Arishalim Shel Sefer Shmuel, sort of a review of the major themes of each of the chapters. I'm going to walk through it, and feel free to jump in, ask questions, just we'll do this as a freestyle dialogue or conversation, but I'm just going to review the major themes of what we have covered. Starting with Perek Aleph. Perek Aleph is the story of the birth of Shmuel. It starts with Chana and her crisis with not having children. Relationship between Chana, Elkanah, Chana and Penina. The side story there is the story of the Mishkan and the role of the Mishkan, Elkanah's annual pilgrimage to Shiloh, whereas nobody else seems to be going to Shiloh, Shiloh seems to be neglected. In the background is this reference to Hophni and Pinchas, sons of Eli, who are there and kind of whose presence overshadows the Mishkan, although we don't learn about them in detail until Perek Bet. The primary theme of Perek Aleph is Chana's inability to have children and her desire to pray. We suggested, based on our understanding of what comes next, that part of her crisis and not being able to pray is the role that Hophni and Pinchas are playing in the determination of who is allowed to be in the Mishkan and who is not. Ultimately, she pushes forward, and she offers a prayer that she wants a child. That child, she promises, will be a Nazir, connects that prayer or that anticipation of it being a barren mother or barren woman who wants a child and devotes that child to being a Nazir, kind of connects that moment to the story of Shimshon, which in the chronology of Sefer Shoftim to Shmuel, Shimshon is the previous generation, so Shimshon is a personality that's very much in the background of her tefillah, essentially saying, I want a child who will finish the job that Shimshon started. And that's how we understood the role of Shmuel and her promise that Shmuel will grow up in the Beit HaMikdash, he'll be a Nazir, he'll devote himself to the Mishkan, he'll be a Shofet, he'll kind of pick up where Shimshon had left off. In the meantime, part of that is also to avenge the Plishtim, because as we see, not explicitly but implicitly, both in her tefillah and in what comes subsequently, the danger facing Israel at that time is the Plishtim, much as it was in the days of Shimshon. And so part of Shmuel's mission is to address both the internal issues, of the spiritual issues of the Mikdash, or the Mishkan, as well as the broader political issues of the Plishtim. That is her tefillah for a child. She has this run-in with Eli, famously, where Eli says to her, why are you a shikur? And she formulates the methodology or the choreography of tefillah balachash, of silent prayer. Ultimately, Eli not understanding where she's coming from or what she's praying for. All of that is Perek Aleph. Perek Bet begins with Tefillat Chana, meaning her tefillah of Hoda'ah, of thanksgiving. She has a child. That child she names Shmuel. Shmuel is named Shmuel because he is... There's two verses that describe the naming of Shmuel. They have different roots. One is right, Sha'ul Mehashem, that is borrowed, and the child Asher She'iltiv, my requested. So she is she plays with the terminology, but she certainly sees Shmuel as being borrowed in the sense of having a mission in life, mission that is a spiritual mission mandate, and that perek introduces us to Chofni Pinchas. So you have on the one hand Shmuel, young boy, is going to grow up in the Beit HaMikdash, he's going to be an apprentice to Eli, who's going to be the resolution, the solution to the problems of the corruption, who's going to be a Navi, he's going to be a Shofet, he's going to be a righteous person, standing in contrast to Chofni Pinchas.
American Gothic, with two pitchforks.
Right. Okay, so Chofni Pinchas, I think we've pretty much exhausted our discussion of Chofni Pinchas. I don't think we need to review Chofni Pinchas too much, but Chofni Pinchas, certainly their corruption, their priorities, their criteria for who gets to come into the Mikdash and who doesn't, is paramount to the story, reflecting the corruption of the Mishkan that ultimately is the source, the reason why nobody's coming to the Mishkan, right? Why the Mishkan is so neglected, and why Chana's tefillah for a son includes a son who will address the corruption of the Mishkan itself. There's also the nevuah to Eli, to the curse, to the Navi comes to Eli to tell him that his house will be destroyed, and that ultimately he is being held accountable for the direction that his sons have taken.
For all time.
For all time.
Is that unusual?
Depends on the depth of the chait, and it depends on what the.
I'm just saying, like, I can't remember anywhere else in Torah where somebody's punished.
Depends what you call the punishment. Like when you just talk about in a certain sense, if you talk about the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash as the punishment for the chait of the Kohanim, that punishes them forever because there's no more Beit HaMikdash in which to function. So there is a certain element at which a punishment has consequences for generations, even if it's not direct. In a certain sense, we're all exile, punished for the chait of Dor HaKhorban. So there are moments that have consequences for generations to come, the Tov and the Ra. Which leads us to Perek Gimel. Perek Gimel kind of reboots the story. We start shift our focus from Eli, Chofni, Pinchas, Elkanah, Chana, the whole kind of introductory generation to Sefer Shmuel, and our focus is now on little Shmuel. Shmuel is a young lad, Shmuel who's sitting in the Beit HaMikdash, who's growing up, who's sleeping in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, supposedly or near the Kodesh HaKadoshim, who is the last hope for Ner Hashem, for Nevuah, and in that context, in the middle of the night, we have this beautiful little naive story about hearing a voice, and thinks the voice is Eli, goes running to Eli, says, "Did you call me?" Eli says, "I didn't call you," goes back to sleep. Hears the voice again, goes back to Eli. "Eli, did you call me? I didn't call you." Realizing that this is, he's sleeping in the base of Mikdash, who in the Mishkan, who else could be calling him? Tells him this is Nevuah. Shmuel answers the call of the Nevuah by saying Hineni, and is given his first Nevuah. His first Nevuah is the prophecy that the Mishkan is going to be destroyed and Eli and his household are going to be killed, which is quite a pill to swallow, and then reflect back to Eli. So Eli comes to him in the morning and says to him, "No, what happened? What was the Nevuah?" And poor little Shmuel is sitting there red in the face, doesn't want to tell him. In the end, he tells him, and ultimately that's the Nevuah in which he's told that the Mikdash, the Mishkan, will be destroyed, and the sons, Hophni and Pinchas, will be killed on the day that the Mishkan is destroyed, as a kind of a siman that this corruption is going to essentially implode on itself. That's Perek Gimel. And all of that kind of scene one, if you will, of the opening of Sefer Shmuel, the early years, birth of Shmuel, first Nevuah, sets the stage for what comes next, which is Perek Dalid and Hay. Perek Dalid is, we actually don't know the time frame of the transition from Perek Gimel to Perek Dalid. Perek Dalid is the war in Eben HaEzer. Big battle with the Plishtim. The Plishtim have marched all the way north into Har Ephraim. They're sitting, Eben Ezer is near Shiloh, so they're sitting in the vicinity of Har Ephraim. If you think about the geography of the land of Israel, that means they've gone from Eretz Plishtim, which is in the south, all the way up to north. Har Ephraim, Shiloh is the northern part of the Shomron. They've essentially moved into the heartland of Israel. And this major battle is such that Israel is losing the battle. The Plishtim have the upper hand. In an act of desperation, they decide to try to shift the power of, or the center of gravity of the battle by taking the Aron out of the Mishkan and bringing it into battle. Charged with that mission are the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Pinchas, who go into the Mishkan, take the Aron, bring it into the battlefield, uncovered with the Kruvim in the battlefield, mixed amongst all of the other schmutz that's out there in the battlefield. The end result isn't good. The Plishtim see the two Kruvim and define and see them and point to them and say, these are the gods of Israel, Hey Israel, essentially further exacerbating the sense of idolatry involved. The result is that they fight even harder, and Israel loses even more. The Aron is captured, Hophni and Pinchas are killed. Eventually, what's not written in that perek, but is recorded in Sefer Tehillim, is that the Mishkan itself is destroyed. Eventually. In the meantime, the word of the capture of the Aron and the death of Hophni and Pinchas and the defeat of Israel on the battlefield all come to Eli. The shock is too much for him, and he has a heart attack, falls off his chair, and dies. And so, in that moment, you have essentially the fall of the house of Eli. Hophni, Pinchas, the battle is lost, sections of the land of Israel are captured, the Mishkan falls, and we have what we have termed essentially the first Churban in magnitude in Sefer Shmuel. Perek Hay shifts our focus from the Aron, from the battlefield with the Plishtim, to the Aron itself. The Aron traces the story of the Aron as it moves into the land of the Plishtim. And it's a very interesting Perek because it's kind of completely isolated from the rest of the Jewish people. We have no idea what's going on in Israel. Our shift of focus is completely into the heartland of Eretz Plishtim, their temples, the Mishkan. Essentially, I think we coined the title for that parak, the Mishkan fights for itself. The Aron fights for itself. The notion that the Aron is going to take on the idols of Dagon and the idols of the Plishtim, they put the Aron into the temple of Dagon, and suddenly the idol of Dagon falls and breaks, and we had an interesting.
A lot better than we did.
You know, remember I even showed you that scene from Raiders of the Lost Ark to get a little bit of a visual sense of the story. The Aron, when Chazal talk about Aron noset nosav, that the Aron carries its those who carry it. Remember the story of later on. Many years later, when David takes the Aron to Yerushalayim and it's Uzzah, the Aron is falling. We read it as Haftarah, and Uzzah reaches out to grab the Aron because it's falling off the wagon, and he's killed for it. So let's read it as Haftarah Parshat Shmini. So the Chazal there say that they should have known better because the Aron noset nosav. The Aron carries those who carry it, and you don't carry the Aron carries you. That idea and the expectation that Israel should know about it, I think really emanates from the story of the Aron in Eretz Plishtim, where you see the Aron essentially fighting the Plishtim in its own terms. There are no Israelites to be found. We're not around. But it fights against the idols, and then there's this plague of Tchorim and Achbarim, and the Plishtim don't know what to do with this, so they take the Aron, stick it on a wagon, put the Achbarim and the Tchorim made out of gold on the wagon, send it back to the land of Israel and say, here, you deal with this. And it comes back to Beit Shemesh. Everybody, right, the Aron finds its way back to Beit Shemesh. People of Beit Shemesh are so excited. They see it. They see the Aron marching on his wagons of carried by cows. They have great celebration. They are ready to open it up. And they look at the Aron, and they look at the Achbarim, and they look at the Tchorim, and the Pasuk says, Vayu'u Baharon, which means either they looked at the Aron, or some suggest they even looked in the Aron. They're kind of singing and dancing and celebrating, and by the time the story is all finished, 50,000 Beit Shemesh, Israelites from Beit Shemesh, die in a plague. And they realize that this is what happens in Beit Shemesh is a reflection of what happened in Eretz Plishtim, no different. Eretz Plishtim, they mistreated the Aron, they were destroyed by a plague. And Beit Shemesh, they mistreated the Aron, they were destroyed by the plague. The Aron is the Aron. The end result is that they come to the conclusion that the Aron is too hot to handle. And so it needs to be set aside. So they call over whoever that is in Kiryat Yarim, not sure why particularly Kiryat Yarim. They send the Aron to hide it amongst those who can preserve and protect it, and rather than rebuilding the Mishkan, they send the Aron into exile. Although in exile, which they knew where it was, and they knew what it was, but nonetheless, the Aron is now in exile. And it sits in a tent in Kiryat Yarim until David calls for it to Yerushalayim.
How many years is that?
So there's a pasuk in the beginning of Perek Zion that says 20 years. And according to some calculations, it's 20 years from that point to David. The problem with that calculation is that it puts all of Sefer Shmuel on the period of leadership of Shmuel and Shaul in a very short time frame, which is not so easy to do. We talked a little bit about the chronology. We're going to get back to that issue of chronology at the beginning of Perek.
Also, I think. How long Eli reigned in or served in Shiloh? Did we figure that out too? Or
no? We know he's an old man when Shmuel enters into the picture, so but we don't have, we know how old he is when he dies, but we don't know
how
where he is in the
no.
We know how long the Mishkan stood in Shiloh, but we don't necessarily know how long Eli was there. The whole period of the Mishkan, from the day it was moved there, which is Yeshua Perek Yerchet, till the day it's destroyed, Chazal calculated as 369 years. And they do that by working backwards. There's 480 years from Yetziat Mitzrayim until the building of the Beit HaMikdash. Beit HaMikdash, Shlomo's fourth year, 40 years of David, right, so 44 years backwards until the end of, till David comes to the throne. So essentially you've got And then you've got periods of, the Mishkan is in Gilgal for 14 years, and after the destruction of the Mishkan it's in Nov for a number of years, so they calculate what's left, and that's the Mishkan in Shiloh. So more or less it's about 350 years. Alright, that's Perek Vav. So Perek Dalet Hey and Vav essentially is this isolated moment of the fulfillment of the Nevuah of Shmuel, the fall of the Mishkan, and the exile of the Aron, the Churban, as it's played out, prophesied by that first Nevuah of Shmuel. Which brings us to Perek Zion. Perek Zion is reversal. Perek Zion is the beginning of the process in reverse. Shmuel Hanavi leadership is reflected, brings about the spiritual revolution, brings about tshuva of the people. There's a whole discussion about how he has his big speech to the people about serving God, Livado, alone, loyal to him. They do tshuva, they remove the idolatry. There's a kind of a spiritual revolution. It doesn't tell us how long it takes the spiritual revolution to take place. One suggestion is that that's the reference to the 20 years, that it's 20 years of Shmuel's leadership of the people to bring about this tshuva. And then, in that context, Shmuel, after that removing of the idolatry, so you now have the address to the root cause, Shmuel leads the people back in battle against the Plishtim. So Shmuel, taking on the role of the Shofet, takes the people, goes back to the Plishtim, and in this time around is victorious. Again, names the place Evan HaEzer, same name, different place. Different meaning. In this case, it's reflecting the Ezra of Hashem. He builds a Mizbeach there, and ultimately they are able to return all the lands that the Plishtim had taken from Israel, all the cities, restoring the sovereignty of Israel. And that's really the beginning of almost the sense Malchut Shmuel, right? The notion that Shmuel is the leader, he's the Shofet, he's the Navi, he's the spiritual leader, he's the military leader. He is really he's the real thing. Right? He's the whole picture, and it's his leadership that is reflected in that one parak Zion.
I'm going to compare him to Moshe.
Compare him to Moshe, both in Moshe v'Aaron b'Chol and Shmuel b'Korei Shemo. In many ways, Shmuel was one of the greatest leaders, Nevi'im and military leaders, etc. It was a remarkable moment in history. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of details because it's one parak. We have one story and one battle, and then the story shifts to the end of his life because it's not the theme of Sefer Shmuel. The theme of Sefer Shmuel is not to tell us about Shmuel. The theme of Sefer Shmuel is to tell us about Shaul and David. So Shmuel's story is there, but it's a very short story. Ultimately, that brings us to Perek Chet. Perek Chet shifts to the end of Shmuel's life. Shmuel is old, his children have not... the Perek begins, Vayhi kasher zaken Shmuel. Shmuel is at the end of Shmuel's life, and his children are shoftim, his children are not necessarily the kind of spiritual depth that their father was. The Navi describes them as taking bribes and behaving in a manner that the people felt was inappropriate. Ultimately, they gather together and make the famous request of Shmuel for a king. Perek Chet is a hard perek to learn to read because it's sort of a very biting and very bitter perek. Shmuel is angry at the people for rejecting him. God says to Shmuel, don't be angry at the people. They're not rejecting you, they're rejecting me. If anybody's going to be angry, it's me. We suggested that there's two voices in that story. There's a voice of the people, there's a voice of the Zkenim. They're worried about leadership, they're worried about they're worried about the spiritual price tag, if you will, of the Shoftim, of not having a standing army and a standing military and a standing king. They want to reverse all of that. Ultimately, they see this as a next step in sovereignty. Shmuel gives them a challenge. He reads to them what we call Mishpat HaMelucha. Mishpat HaMelucha is the laws of the authority of a king, the powers of a king. The powers of a king essentially define the king as giving him the authority to do whatever it takes to establish a standing army. And the people said, yes, that's exactly what we want. We want the king to establish a standing army. Lo ki malachim lo chaleinu. And so Shmuel sends them all home and he says, fine, you want a king? Go home, I'll find you a king. That's Perek Chet. Perek Tet flips the picture. And Chet, Tet, Yud Aleph, Yud Bet is a kind of ping pong, back and forth, alternating prakim, reflecting the positive side of kingship and the negative side of kingship. When we learned it through, we sort of looked at that kind of oscillating impression of is it a good thing or a bad thing. So whereas Perek Chet is this biting critique of the people for wanting a king, Perek Tet describes the naivete and the purity and the kedusha by which the first king of Israel is chosen. God sends Shmuel the choice. There's this young man, and he's a shepherd, and he's looking for his father's donkeys, and he's lost, and he ends up showing up at Shmuel's town, and he comes to Shmuel and he says, I'm looking for my donkeys, and Shmuel says to him, I'm looking for the next king of Israel, and you're it. And there's this beautiful, naive, orchestrated, divine providence moments of I've got this whole party ready, we're just waiting for the guest of honor to arrive, you happen to come in at the right time, at the right moment, you're it. Takes him up to the roof, has a whole conversation with him about the geopolitical picture of Israel, falls in love with him, he sees him as his protege, and Shaul is smitten with, and Shmuel is smitten with Shaul, and he is now his choice for king. In that moment, in Perek Tet, in Perek Yud, he says to him, as you leave, I'm going to give you three tests or three signs that will demonstrate to you, A, that everything that I've been telling you as the Navi is correct, that you are the next king of Israel, but more importantly, that will help you transition from your role as a shepherd to recognize that you are the king of Israel and that the people will acknowledge you as their king. Those three otot we spend some time looking at, the people from Kfurat Rachel or Kever Rachel will come to you and bring you bread, will bring you tidings. Anashim Alchim LeMikdash, you have the three people on the way to Mikdash who bring offerings, they're going to bring you bread, they're going to give you part of the offerings of the Mikdash, which of the Korbanot, which is also a gift to the king. And then, of course, the third, which is this band of Nevi'im, in which he will be engulfed and brought into Gam Sha'ub Nevi'im, this the trance of V'nehepachta L'Ishacher, through which you will be transformed into a different person.
So was he, is Shaul considered a Navi too, or no? Or he can't?
He's not a Navi, but there's these schools of Nevi'im which are involved in these kind of meditative trances. That not so much Navua, but to be brought into that kind of spiritual moment. Hagam Shaul Benavim was a statement, right? He's a shepherd. What's he doing amongst the schools of prophets? Not necessarily a reflection that he's a Navi as much as it is a moment of transformation for him. And all of that to demonstrate that he is the choice for king. The end of the parak is important for us. The end of the parak is the first public ceremonial coronation of Shaul as king. There's a big ceremony. Shmuel gathers the people. He uses a lottery or goral to determine which family, which household, which tribe, ultimately which individual is the Bechirat Hashem, the one who was chosen by God. Right? And that's the message. The message is Ha'item Asher Bechar Hashem Bo, the one who God will choose. Som tasim alech ha-melech asher yivcha Hashem alakecha, the king whom God will choose to place over you as the king. And so that choice lands on Shaul ben Kish, who at that moment was nowhere to be found because he was hiding. Nechba el hakelim, he was hiding. The goral shevet Binyamin, and the goral to family of Kish, etc. Goral falls on Shaul ben Kish, and he's not there. Kind of have this vision of the end of the Sound of Music when they announce the Van Trapp family singers, and nobody shows up. Right, Shaul ben Kish, and nobody's there. And so they don't know what to do. God says to Shmuel, he's hiding there. Nechbal HaKelim. Shmuel goes running up to him, grabs him, brings him, stands him before the people. And he's very tall and very strapping and very impressive. And Shmuel says to the people, V'yom HaShmuel HaKol HaAm, Hari Item HaShem B'char Bo HaShem. Now you see the one that God has chosen. Ki Ein Kamo B'chol HaAm. There's no one like him in amongst the people. That is true. Nobody like him. People cry out and they say, Yechi HaMelech, long live the king. On the other hand, ends Perek Yud with the the tragic statement. Pasuk Chav Zayin, Vayivunei V'lial Amru Ma Yoshiyinu Zeh. There were Bnei B'lial. Bnei B'lial is a term that in Sefer Shmuel has a unique connotation, because it reminds us of Chafni Pinchas, Bnei B'lial Lo Yadu At Hashem. These Bnei B'lial turn to the choice of God as for Shmuel, Shaul as king, and they said, this one is going to save us. What is this? This is a nothing. Has no backbone. He may stand tall, but he has no backbone. Ma yoshienu zeh. Vayivzu, they disparaged him. They publicly derided him. V'lo hivyu lo mincha. They didn't bring him the gifts that normally you bring to the king. Vayhi kamachamish, Shaul's response was
silence.
Shaul's response was silence because he himself didn't really get it, didn't understand it. He himself went home. Right? It says that everybody went home. Vayishalach Shmuel et kol ha'am ish leveito. Shmuel sent everybody back home. V'gam Shaul alach leveito. Shaul also went home. Everybody was going home, so Shaul also went home. Right? I would assume that if you're first king of Israel, you build a palace and you...
Where were they when all this was going on?
They are in the first tekes of, they're in a place called Mitzpeh. Vayatzek Shmuel et ha'am el Hashem ha-Mitzpah. Where in these places are, it's interesting, there's three different places in Israel that are referred to as Mitzpeh. Mitzpeh is a high place of some kind. But certainly a place of significance there in this place called Mitzpeh. There is the ceremony. Shaul goes home. Shaul lives in... I assume he lives in Givat Shaul. Where else is Shaul going to live? And he goes...
Which is near Front Shaul?
Excuse me?
Which is now near Front
Shaul? In Shevet Binyamin. That's Perigit. That's how Perigit ends. This great ceremony, and everybody goes home. Which brings us to a transition to Perek Yud Aleph, which is the last Perek that we actually looked at before the break. Perek Yud Aleph is the battle of Yavesh Gilad. Complete different change of tenor, tone, picture, scene, as if nothing happened. We don't know anything. There's no palace, there's no army, there's no king, there's nothing. There's just city of Yavesh Gilad sitting out on the border of on the east side of the Yarden in the Eretz Gilad, attacked by Nachash, king of Ammon. The Nachash, king of Ammon, threatens the people of Yavesh Gilad. He threatens them with slavery. He threatens them with gouging out their right eye. And Kol Lechem Kol Ayin Yamin, the people of Yavesh Gilad ask for 7 days to kind of figure things out. They send messengers throughout the land of Israel saying, we are being attacked by Yavesh Gilad, by Nachash, king of Ammon. He's threatening to take out our right eye. What should we do? Everybody hears the response and starts to cry. Shaul, and this is like one of the most remarkable psukim. Perek Yud Aleph, Pasuk Hey. V'hine Shaul ba acharei bakar min ha-sadeh. Perek Yud Aleph, Pasuk Hey. V'hine Shaul ba acharei bakar min ha-sadeh. Shaul comes marching in from the field, from shepherding his father's flock. This is Perek Yud Aleph after Perek Yud. So he's already been had this public ceremony. So some of Hashem said, this is so strange, it's so inconceivable that after the ceremony of Perek Yud, you'd have this story. That some suggest actually that there's this disconnect, chronological disconnect. But that doesn't work, because the end of the story, when Shaul is finally successful in battle against the people of Yavesh Gilad, the response of Israel is to say, you remember those people who yesterday said, Ma Yoshienu Zeh, let's take care of them. So there is a connection between the two stories. But nonetheless, you see that nothing happened in Perek Yud. They all had this public ceremony and they all went home and that was the end of it. Now they're all waiting to see what happens. In the meantime, Shaul comes in. He hears this story of the people crying about Yavesh Gilad. And they're all sitting going, Poor Yavesh Gilad, they're going to get destroyed by Nachash, king of Ammon. And Joel says, no, they're not. Not unless we let them. Right? This is not, it's not a time to cry. It's a time to take up arms and go and defend them. And so he has a very interesting way of drafting his soldiers. He takes the two oxen, he cuts them up, sends a piece of them to each of the tribes of Israel and says to them, either come fight or thus will happen to your ox, to your cattle, which is another way of saying either come fight or thus will happen to you. Reminiscent of another story which we spent some time looking at, which is the only other time that the Israeli Postal Service was used to deliver body parts, and that's Pelegesh Begiva. And Pelegesh Begiva, as we understood it, is also a story that relates to Yavesh Gilad, because Yavesh Gilad was the innocent city on the eastern side of the Yarden that the people of Israel went and destroyed because of their supposed apathy and non-involvement in the battle of the civil war against Binyamin. So here is Shaul, anointed king from Sheva Binyamin, drafting the tribes of Israel to come and fight in defense of Yavesh Gilad, handful of years after a tragedy of a different generation where the tribes of Israel had gathered together to go and destroy Yavesh Gilad. That's the transition moment. Not an accident that Shaul borrows that methodology of Pelegesh Begiva, sends this out to the people of Israel and says, we gather together now or you die. Pulls together, not surprisingly, an army of 330,000 soldiers. That's an army. 330,000 soldiers. And they march on Yavesh Gilad to defend it against Nachash, king of Ammon. I suspect Nachash, king of Ammon, wasn't expecting more than a couple of thousand, because the result was that within a couple of hours they were completely vanquished and destroyed. And the people turn to Shaul and they say, this is our king. And that's where our story picks up. So let's now turn to the end of Perek Yud Aleph. More or less in the last 37 minutes, we have kind of summarized where we're at in Sefer Shmuel. It's a very dangerous game.
It's the cliff notes.
Right, it's the cliff notes. The story of... Okay. So let's pick up from Pasuk Yud Aleph. Vahimi mocharat vayasem Shaul et ha'am shlosha rashim revo betoch ha'machaneh v'ashmonat ha'boker v'yaku et amon ad chom hayom. The next day Shaul gathers his people, he divides them into three groups or three platoons, whatever you want to call it. I assume two to attack front and back, and one to from three sides to allow them a fourth side to retreat from. They attack at morning dawn. By noon, ad chom hayom, Ammon is gone. Vayi anisharim vayafutzu v'lo nisharu bam shnayim yachad. The rest scattered, they ran away. There weren't two left together, meaning the entire army was completely disbanded. Vayomer ha'am el Shmuel. Mi ha'omer sha'u yimloch aleinu. Tnua anashim u'nimitem. Said the people to, who they're speaking to is interesting here. Shaul. The people said to, Vayomer ha'am el Shmuel. So Shmuel's there. Clearly he had to have been there. The people turned to Shmuel and they said to him, Mi ha'omer sha'ul yimloch aleinu. All those people who yesterday, figuratively, said disparagingly about Shaul, ma yoshienu zeh, what is this one going to do for us? All those people who were so disparaging about Shaul, tnu ha'nashim unimitem, give them to us that we may execute them. Why execute them?
Because they were traitors.
Because they're guilty of insubordination to the king is called treason. Guilty of treason. When you're guilty of treason, it's a death penalty. You publicly curse the king, that's a death penalty. Shimon Ben Gera, other stories in Sefer Shmuel. You can't do that.
But he wasn't really acting like a king.
Doesn't matter. He was the king. Shaul had appointed him. God had appointed him. The Goral had appointed him. Right? They were accountable. In Perek Yud, it said that Shaul's response was, he didn't see himself as a king, and therefore he didn't respond. But now, in hindsight, here, clearly, this is Shaul kingly, right? This is Shaul HaMelech. Then they, in hindsight, those people now are... Right, they are the ones who, between the two groups, one was vindicated, so they wanted exact revenge against the group that was not guilty. Vayomer Shaul lo yumat ish bayom azeh ki hayom asa Hashem tshuah b'Yisrael. No, says Shaul, this is not a day to kill any people. This is a day to celebrate the great victory of God has done for Israel. So, point of observation. Who responds?
Shaul.
To whom was the question?
Shmuel.
It's interesting dialogue. The people turn to Shmuel to say, okay, now we're going to defend Shaul. And Shaul steps in, assuming, number one, that he's the only one who can step in. Guilty of treason, there's only one person who can pardon somebody guilty of treason, and that's the king. So in a sense, it's a second act as king. One is to lead the people into battle, and the other, as the shofet, as the judge, is to say, right, to respond and say, no, we're not killing anybody today. This is not a day. This is a day to celebrate. It's a day to forgive trespasses, to forgive those the doubters. This is a day to celebrate. Asa Hashem tshuah b'Yisrael. Even the phraseology tshuah b'Yisrael is reminiscent of that dialogue, because what was it that the naysayers, what phrase did the naysayers use back in Perek Yud? Ma Yoshienu Zeh. What is this one going to do to save us? To which Shaul responds and says, not Ki Asiti Tshuah B'Yisrael, but rather Ki Asa Hashem Tshuah B'Yisrael. Tshuah belongs to the Ribbono Shel Olam. I'm an agent. Which is a very powerful statement and appropriate for Melech B'Yisrael.
He had it all right in the beginning.
He certainly did. He had it all right. He had all the potential. He could not have been chosen had he not had all the pieces and potential right. Where he goes wrong, we will see B'Ezrat Hashem and explore in detail. Because that's the subject for this year, is essentially through the story of Amalek. That's our agenda for the year. So we'll spend some time looking at Shaul. That's the end of the story. That next paragraph break really reflects the fact that this story has now come to an end. Shaul is the last word. A tribute to the Tshuah, to the Ribbono Shel Olam, but at the same time spares the people of, pardons the naysayers from their insubordination. Shaul is now really a melech b'Yisrael. Vayomer Shmuel el ha'am, lechu v'nelcha ha'gilgal, v'nechadesh sham ha'melucha. Says Shmuel to the people, come, let's go to Gilgal, and there we will renew the malchus. Vayelchu kol ha'am ha'gilgal, vayamlichu sham et Shaul lifnei Hashem ba'gilgal. They go to Gilgal, they make Shaul king, they anoint him as king, they designate him as king. Before Hashem in Gilgal, Vayizbuchu Shem Zvachim Shlamim Lifnei Hashem, they bring all kinds of korbanot to God. Vayismach Shem Shaul V'chol Anshei Yisrael Ad Ma'od. It's a big party, big celebration, Shaul and all the people together. Which raises several questions. Question number one would be,
how did everybody know to go there?
No. Are you really told? Right? Shmuel says to people, let's go to Gilgal, and People go to Gagala. How did anybody know anything in those days? Right? Messengers, information, travels.
Why renew that?
Right. Why?
It was an order.
There was already, they already did this. Why repeat the story? They have already appointed Shaul as king back in Perek Yud. Whole ceremony in Mitzpeh with the Goral and with the designation. Right? And all that they've done now is vindicated God's choice of king. Why do I need to go back to celebrating it? Fine. But the language here is Nechadesh Sham Hamelucha. We're going to renew the king. And the Vayamlichu Sham et Shaul. They coronate Shaul. So there's a second coronation ceremony that is going to take place now. And that is the subject of Perek Yudbet. Perek Yudbet is the repeat of the. I can't imagine we repeat, it's a different version, different story, but a second beginning of a reboot of the coronation of Shaul. Now, the problem with Perek Yudbet, we will see this B'srat Hashem next week, the problem with Perek Yudbet is that it cuts back to the theme of Shmuel being critical of the people for requesting a king. And he yells at them and he says, you've done evil and you've done a terrible thing and here's the kingdom you chose. It's back to that Perekhet theme. So that we'll have to address, that back and forth again. But why need to go there in the first place?
So few people accepted him.
Oh.
So, consensus.
Right. So there is this suggestion that is put forward in the Mefarshim that whereas the first coronation ceremony starts off on the left foot, it starts with this machloket, some accept him, some don't accept him, we don't necessarily know the numbers, it was necessary at this point to kind of reboot that process. So if you flip the page over for a moment. It's a host of Mefarshim along the same lines as we through what you're suggesting. Rashi, Vayomer Shmuel, Nechadesh Shama Melucha, Lefi Shebarishona Hayu Orim Al HaDavar, V'yata Nitratzu Kula. First time around, there were those who didn't accept it. So now, after the great victory of Shaul and the great demonstration of Shaul's ability to lead, they were ready and willing to accept him as king. Similarly, the Radak, Menachadesh HaMamelucha, Lefi Shepam HaRishana, Mikzatam Bizuhu, first time around, there were those who spoke disparagingly about him. V'yomru Mar Yoshienu Zeh, Achshav nitratzu kulam mipnei hatshua shebal yado b'melchemet Nachash. Now they were all appeased because of the great victory. V'yamar Shmuel chadesh hamelucha b'Gilgal lechvod. We'll talk. That's a separate piece. That's why in Gilgal. That's the second question. The second question is why go back to Gilgal. I'm not sure we're going to get to that question today. But why Gilgal is also an issue because Gilgal is a non-issue, is a non-entity for them since the days of Yoshua. Mishkan was never in Gilgal anymore. Mishkan was in Gilgal. First step was it's the first encampment of Israel was in Gilgal. Why go back to Gilgal for this second ceremony? The Aron's not there. The Mizbeach's not there. They got to build a Mizbeach there to bring Korbanot. The whole thing is very strange. Why in Gilgal? But I'm going to leave that for another conversation. Rabag also suggests something similar. Laila Zot Siba Sibev Shmuel Chadesh Melucha BeGilgal Gilu Hirash Adata Lo Haya Melech Bishlemut. The first time around, it wasn't wholeheartedly. It wasn't Bishlemut. Now it's really Bishlemut. This is something which they want to do.
Was the Shlemut the people and Shaul? Because when you think about it, Shaul at first he went to his own house. He didn't do the king. So maybe this is a completion of both the people and the Melech.
And I would say that's true. And you can see from the celebration, Ve'ismach Sham Shaul v'chol anshei Yisrael Admon. The celebration is everybody, Shmuel, Shaul, the people. This is really a remarkably positive coming together of all of the components that we have we've seen. I would even go one step further to suggest that it's necessary to have this kind of second ceremony. Because the first time around, who chose the king?
Shmuel.
Right? Shmuel through the Goral, meaning God. Right? Meaning God. But that's insufficient. at some point or another, the people, in order to be loyal to the king, have to have their own buy-in to the choice of king. So on a certain level, this was inevitable. It was inevitable that God would choose the king and the people would say, yay or nay. And then they'd have to see, they'd have to buy, they'd have to, he'd have to prove himself. But once he proves himself and they realize that the choice of God was really correct, then they would be loyal to him. And if you look at the chart that I, the two psukim that I put side by side on this page, right, Perek Yud, the emphasis was, Vayomer Shmuel, Kol Ha'am, Hara'item Asher Bachar Bo Hashem. Have you seen the one that God has chosen? Ki'en kamo b'chala. Clearly emphasizing that the choice of king was God's. Whereas here, from the very suggestion, v'yomer Shmuel al ha'am, l'chu v'nechal gagal v'nechadesh ha'am ha'malucha, v'yalchu kol ha'am ha'gilgal v'yamlichu shamat Sha'ul lifnei Hashem ba'gilgal, who's coronating the king? The people. And the emphasis here is clearly on the choice of the people. Now there is a halacha, this is more than just a we see play out in Tanakh. There is actually a halacha formulated on this basis that says, you have it in source 5, Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, Ein ma'amidin panas al tzibur el imkein nimlachim batzibur. You cannot appoint a leader over the people until you first consult with the people. As a prerequisite, somebody who had to have authority over the people, there has to be a sense of buy-in from the people themselves.
It's the birth of democracy.
In a certain sense, there is a democratic principle involved. Because you, even though you're talking about a melech, but the first melech has to be established with the authority of the king, of the people. The Rambam, for example, Ein ma'amidim melech batchila, ela al pi beitin shoshivim zkenim ve'al pi navi. The first king in a dynasty. Melech batchila means the first king of a dynasty. Second king of the dynasty is not a problem, because this melech by definition means it's a dynasty, right? Ben Achaben, the oldest son of the choice wife of the king is the one who is the heir to the throne. That's built into the Malchus. But you can't start Malchus until you establish the commitment of the people to that choice of the beginning of the Melech. And therefore, Rambam writes, it's not enough to have the Navi. Based on the Psukim that we have learned up until now, all you need is the Navi. Perek Yud, all you have is the Navi. Perek Yud Aleph and Yud Bet is the Beit Din. Ein ma'amidin melech b'tchila ela al pi Beit Din shoshivim zkenim ve'al pi navi. Ki Yoshua sheminah Moshe Rabbeinu Beit Dino u'kesha'ul v'David sheminam Shmuel Aramati u'Beit Dino. Who designated Sha'ul? Shmuel and his Beit Din. Shmuel is the Navi, the Beit Din is the people. It's a very important principle. I'll come back to the Rambam in a moment. The Ramban, I mean. Take a look at the Radvaz. It's a really remarkable Radvaz. Davar ben Zimri. Source 8. V'hai melech. This king of Israel, Shumlach al yedei Navi, is somebody who is anointed by the king, by the Navi. Or somebody whom the people of Israel have agreed on. That phrase of the Radvaz is a remarkable chiddush. Because what the Radvaz suggests, unlike the Rambam, who says that in order to appoint a king you need the Navi and the Beit Din, the Radvaz's language is you need the Navi or the people. Haim melech shumlach al yedei navi, o sheiskimu alav ko Yisrael. So I'll tell you, Rav Kook, Tzvi Yehuda Kook, Avraham Yitzchok also, but he didn't see it, so he kind of envisioned it, but Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook really developed this idea that the the democratic representation of the choice of the people as a leader has the halachic status of melech on the basis of this Radbaz. Because melech doesn't have to be an individual. Melech is an authority. Melech is a machut. It's an authority that gives you the right to build an army, it gives you the right to declare war, it gives you the right to endanger the lives of individual citizens of the people of Israel to protect the whole. That's what an army is. So where does that authority come from? So there's two primary sources that are quoted in the writings of Rav Kook to define the authority of that democratically elected governing body. One is as a Meiri, and the other is this Radvaz. He says that the authority of king, of kingship, comes from one of two sources. Either the Navi, or Sheskimu Alav Kol Yisrael. That acceptance of Israel as a people, that's critical. And that's what you have here. So whereas up until now we've had this picture that God has to choose the king and comes to the people and he has to and the Navi will convince the people, etc. What you have played out here is the sense that notwithstanding God's choice, it doesn't really become fixed until the people make that decision.
So based on this, would you say halachically Jews living in Israel have it's a mitzvah for them to vote?
Oh yeah. Rav Kook felt that the state of Israel today has the status of Malchut Yisrael, which has all kinds of ramifications. And it's not just about voting, it's about the status of the government and the laws of the government, and etc. It's all kinds of enormous ramifications. Not so black and white, but certainly there is that perspective is there.
Like here, you know, sometimes you have less than 50% of the people vote. So you don't even have a majority of people voting to decide who's going to be governing.
Right. Well, you have a much higher percentage in Israel. So just in practical terms, you have a much higher percentage. The last thing I want to leave you with is this Ramban. Ramban is a remarkable, remarkable Chiddush. If we go back to the story of Malchus in the Torah, go back to that famous series of psukim we've looked at a number of times. I'm going to point something out to you which I don't know if we've ever really stopped and thought about. Take a look at Devarim Perek Yud Zayin. That page, somebody will find the page.
It depends what pasuk, but it's 232.
The pasuk would be Yudalid. 232. Ki tavo al ha'aretz asher Hashem lekecha noten lach v'dishta v'yashavta ba v'yamarta asima alayim melech kochol ha'goyim asher sivivotai. We've looked at these psukim when we did Parakhet at length. You'll come to the land of Israel, there'll come a time, you will say after you've settled the land, conquered it, you will say, I want a king like all the nations around me. That's what you'll say. I'm interested right now in Pasuk Tet Vav. Som tasim alach ha-melech asher yivchar Hashem Elokecha bo. Translate.
You shall surely
appoint a king. Whom?
That Hashem will choose.
First half of the Pasuk, you will choose a king whom? You will appoint for yourselves a king whom? God will choose. Fine. Next part of the pasuk.
Amongst your brothers?
Mikerev achecha tasim alech ha-melech. Amongst your brothers, you need to appoint this king. Lo tuchal latet alecha ish nochri asher lo achichahu. You may not appoint a stranger, non-Jew, who's not from your brothers to be your king. Straightforward? Okay. I have a simple question. Ramban's question. If God is choosing the king, why does the Torah need to tell me that I'm not allowed to take a Gentile as a king?
Because
if the pasuk says that God will choose the king, and you must accept the king whom God chooses, so tasim alach amalach, asher yivchar Hashem elokecha, why do I need to then say, mikerev achecha tasim alach amalach, lo tuchal latet alach ish nochri? It's not our choice. Of course God's going to appoint somebody who's acceptable, right? The two halves of this pasuk contradict each other.
Maybe there's an inference that people have a choice also.
So that's the Ramban's question. It's a remarkable question.
When we don't govern ourselves.
So the first answer, which is the classic, I would say the traditional answer, is that it depends. If there's a Navi, and the Navi is able to appoint the king, whoever God will choose, that will be a king. But there are times when you won't have a Navi. And if you don't have a Navi, what are you going to do? You're going to have to appoint your own king. And then there are parameters. That's the classic answer to this question. It's either the Navi will choose, which is preferable, or that won't be an option, in which case, here are the minimum parameters. Ramban says that's napshat. Doesn't say either or. So now look at this Ramban. Tam, source 7. The Tam Hashem Yivchar Hashem Elokecha Bo Al Da'at HaMefarshim Sheyen Yivchar Al Pi Navi or B'Mishpat Ta'urim. The Mefarshim suggest, Rashi, based on the Gemara, that it means with a Navi and or the Goral, the Urim V'Tumim, some mechanism by which we understand God's choice. Yitzaveh HaKatuv Tasim Alecha Melech Hashem Yivchar Hashem Elokecha Bo Ki Hu Yivchar V'Lo Ata. God will choose, not you. And then there's another series of drashot from the Sifrei that he quotes. Tasam tismalach melech meit manach etachtav melech v'lo malkah shivchar Hashem elokecha pi navi. All right, skip all that. Fourth line from the bottom. Imken ma tam lazhir lo tuchal latet alecha ish nachri. If that's the case, then why do I need to tell me not to appoint a non-Jew? V'Hashem lo yivchar b'nachri. God is not going to choose a nachri. So Chazar would have to say that there's a kind of a conditional statement. It's an either or. If God answers with the Nevi'im, you'll be able to find a king by a Navi. But if there's no Navi, so no, minimally, you can't appoint a king on your own who's not from your people. Says the Ramban. He says, that's the Midrash. That's the Sifrei. Now I'll tell you the Pshat. What's the Pshat? Som tasim alech ha-melech ha-she yivchar ha-shem alokech ha-bo ve-lo ha-sher sene ha-shem alokech ha-bo. Bechira and sin'ah are terms that we use in the Torah not to reflect choice in the sense of I choose this one, right, to tell you the choice, but they reflect a positive and negative attitude towards. What do I mean? There's a mitzvah in the Torah it's actually in the same parasha where it talks about if a person has two wives, right? One is it's talking about the firstborn. Kiela ish shtei nashim. The Torah says, achat ahuva ve'achat snu'a. One loved and one's hated. One love. Who has two wives? One he loves, one who hates. What it means is, in the Pshat, is that there's usually when you have two wives, certainly in the context of the Torah, in all the precedents of multiple wives, Abraham who has Sarah and he has Hagar, Yitzchak who has Leah and Rachel and then takes Bilhah and Zilpah, you have David and Malach. In all the contexts where you have multiple wives, there's always one who is the primary wife and the one who is the secondary wife. The primary wife is called the Ahuva. The secondary, for the purpose of having children or whatever it may be, Pilegesh, is called the Snu'a. Not because there's an emotional attachment, but because there's a choice attachment. Yaakov and Esav chosen by God. Yaakov is chosen, Esav is rejected, says the Navi Malachi, opening phrase of Sefer, you don't have to turn to it, I'll just quote it. Opening phrase of Sefer Malachi, Ahavti etchem amar Hashem, I loved you, says God. V'amartem b'ma evtanu. You said to me, how did that love manifest itself? Hello, ach Esav liYaakov, num Hashem, ach Yaakov and Esav were brothers. V'ahav et Yaakov et Esav saneti. I loved Yaakov, I despised Esav. Why did he despise Esav? An emotional hatred towards Esav? The Rebbeinu Shlomo doesn't have emotional hatred. What it means is that the one who's chosen, the one who has the status of the am nivchar, segula, bechira, ahava, they're all terms that are used to describe the same phenomena. The correct one, the choice one, says the Ramban, that's what it means. Som tasim alecha melech ashe yivchar Hashem alokach haba, you shall appoint for yourself a king who is the correct choice. Not the despised choice, not the rejected choice, not the wrong choice. What is it about the choice of king that is the correct choice? Ki hu bachar b'Yisrael v'liot hamolech mi'bachorah v'lo mikerav ha'amim asher saneh. He chose Israel. And so he chose that the king of Israel should be a member of the Jewish people and not a member of the nations whom he has rejected. Understand the message? Doesn't mean you shall appoint a king whom God will choose through a Navi Urim V'Tumim and then you're stuck with the choice. You appoint yourself a king. You make the designation. You make the choice. But it has to be somebody whom God will consider an appropriate choice. What's that criteria? He offers a second pshat, but it comes to the same thing. That ultimately, the way the Ramban reads the Pasuk is that the requirement of a selection of a king is not God's selection. It's not the Navi selection. All of that is a kind of a backdrop to help narrow down the field. So you get an election. In this case, it's an election with one candidate, but it's still an election. The people have to want it, they have to accept it, they have to designate it. And so the second ceremony in Gilgal now has far more importance, says according to this Ramban, halachic and otherwise, has far more significance than the first election. God can set up all the pieces of the puzzle. But the people have to choose the king. Which is a very different perspective on the mitzvah of Minyan Melech than all the other Rishonim that we've seen up until now. So I leave that you with this Ramban to consider, to think about. Next week we start Perek Yud Bet.